A deadly virus is released by the thawing permafrost in Greenland.
Now that the Arctic has opened up in terms of navigation by ship, both Greenland and Russia have opened their northern borders to mining. So millions of tons of permafrost are being dug up and turned over in Greenland and Russia. And so that seemed to me, as I was reading about it, not a matter of if, but of when, in terms of when something like this is going to happen.
That's novelist Jim Shepherd. We talk with him about his latest work of fiction, Phase 6. Then we talk with Cobb Carlson about his new documentary film, The Greatest Radio Station in the World. It's about WPKN in Bridgeport, Connecticut, which just happens to be the home station of Writer's Voice. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice, in-depth conversation with writers of all genres, on the air since 2004. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. One of the least known but most terrifying consequences of global warming is the potential release of ancient pathogens from the melting permafrost. Lethal viruses and bacteria that have been locked up for many millennia, and against which humans have zero immunity, pose the threat of lethal pandemics that could take out millions, if not billions, of human beings and other animals. In his new novel, Phase 6, Jim Shepherd brings together two interrelated trends that increase the risk. The thawing Arctic is leading to more mining, and that mining threatens to release pathogens that are new to human immune systems. A mining operation in Greenland releases a virus that wipes out an Inuit community, save for the sole survivor, a young boy. As the deadly virus spreads, two young investigators from the CDC race to identify the pathogen and sequence its genome. The connections between the scientists and the young boy the CDC has taken charge of pose questions about the moral responsibilities we owe each other and how we carry them out. In addition to Phase 6, Jim Shepherd is the author of seven other novels, including The Book of Aaron. Jim Shepherd, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thanks for having me.
This is a terrific novel, Phase 6. It's a work of speculative fiction set, I assume, in the very near future that brings together two existential threats facing human society, climate change and pandemics. And it connects them. It concerns the release of an ancient pathogen from the formerly frozen permafrost that sets off a highly lethal pandemic. And I wanted to ask you first, is that a plausible threat?
Alas, yes, it is, Francesca. In fact, the novel came from a story you might remember from about, 6 or 7 years ago, maybe now at this point, that concerned a 12-year-old boy who died mysteriously in Siberia. And when the Russians investigated it, they discovered that he'd been killed by anthrax. And he had infected 20 others in his village. The Russians panicked because they hadn't seen that form of anthrax in over 75 years. And it turned out after their investigation that long dormant spores of the bacteria that had been frozen in a reindeer carcass had rejuvenated themselves to infect the boy. Essentially what had happened was that as the permafrost got dug up and thawed out, spores that had been long dormant reactivated themselves. And while we know that there's all sorts of pathogens in the permafrost, in the case of viruses will survive in that state, but need to be actively revivified, which of course, given our lunacy, some people are actually setting out to do. But in the case of sporulating bacteria like anthrax, nobody needs to revive them. They will revive on their own. And I started obsessing about that and reading about it and set that alongside another news item, which you might have tracked, which is that now that the Arctic has opened up in terms of navigation by ship, both Greenland and Russia have opened their northern borders to mining. So millions of tons of permafrost are being dug up and turned over in Greenland and Russia. And so that seemed to me, as I was reading about it, not a matter of if, but of when, in terms of when something like this is going to happen. And I'm one of those people who try to live by that old advice that exhausted and despairing career counselors give, which is sort of find something you're doing anyway and find a way to make it pay. So I thought, well, if I'm going to be obsessing about this, maybe I should try to write about it. And that's where the novel began.
Yeah, and it's a beautiful novel. And when I say beautiful, it's a terrifying story, beautifully written, and also with profoundly human themes in it. But it also really goes into the science in a very interesting way. So talk to us a little bit about how this pathogen operates.
Well, one of the things I wanted to do, this was all, of course, conceived and written before COVID. And one of the things I wanted to do, given that this was a novel that was not only designed to terrify, but also to deliver pleasure, was to create a pathogen that was almost entirely unknown. I always loved those kinds of stories when I was young, where people have no idea what they're dealing with. And one of the ways in which I operate when I'm working with this kind of science is I'll often, because I teach at a liberal arts college, I'll often just dump the problem into the laps of people who know a lot more than I do. And so there's a colleague here who's an epidemiologist and a microbiologist. And I said to her, essentially, here's what I would like in narrative terms. I would like to have a pathogen that is, in fact, very hard to pin down in terms of its essential nature. What would that pathogen look like? It's also going to have to be something that comes out of the permafrost. And she took the idea and was delighted with the problem and ran with it. And what we came up with was imagining a bacteria that can download its RNA and DNA before it gets cleared out of the system. And there's all sorts of examples of that that have scientifically come to light recently. And what that would allow is an infection that essentially can't be traced at first. And so that was the basic science behind the premise.
And I just want to go back to something that you just said before, and that is that people are reviving viruses from the permafrost?
Yeah, believe it or not, there's government-sponsored labs, not just the U.S., but I think it's happening in Holland and France and a few other places too, where they're reviving viruses that they're finding in the permafrost to see if, first of all, to see if they could do it. And that's one of those scientific forays that goes under the heading of what could go wrong. And there's also, of course, in a more sinister terms, there's what they call gain-of-function research, where a lot of people are dealing with very, very serious pathogens under the justification of, well, if we can figure out how to make vaccines in advance, we'll be safe from these things. But that means reviving them and toying and playing around with them. And of course, that's a very dangerous idea as well. And so we have all of these possible avenues for disaster in terms of pandemic. One being what everybody imagined COVID was, which was, you know, something coming out of the mammals piled up upon one another in the wet markets in China. The other was the conspiracy theory that a lot of people thought COVID was, which is the, you know, something walking out of a lab or being released accidentally from a lab. And because of gain of function research, we know that that's going on. And then finally, there's this other thing where people are going, well, let's see what we can revive from the permafrost. And, you know, that seems nuts to me, but a lot of things that governments do seem nuts to me.
Yeah, that's terrifying. And by the way, you know, The Intercept has done an in-depth investigation reviving, actually, the idea that there does seem to be some indication that COVID may have originated in the Wuhan lab with the gain-of-function research.
The governments of the world, and including the U.S. government, fell all over themselves to eliminate that possibility early on. And it seems very clear that that possibility has not been eliminated, partially because we should have been able to find the origin of COVID by now if COVID came out of a wet market, and we haven't been able to do that. And the zeal with which everybody decided it wasn't a lab thing felt a lot more like people covering their butts and saying, let's not go down that road because that's a dangerous investigative subject. Because, of course, if people want to look into that, then the next question becomes, well, who is doing that anyway? How many countries are doing this? And no country that's up to that activity wants it publicized.
Yeah, this is indeed scary. So now let's go back to phase six. Oh, and what does the title refer to?
Phase six is the ultimate level of alarm that the World Health Organization will signal. That means that it's a worldwide pandemic and it's officially, not officially out of control, but they've found a lovely kind of reassuring language for, we haven't quite got control of this yet. So that would be what phase six means in scientific terms for the title. There's also a more human corollary for the science, as there is throughout a lot of the novel. In this case, one of the female EIS officers sent by the CDC, Epidemic Intelligence Service officers sent by the CDC, feels as though she's had a fairly disastrous romantic life. And she describes one of her missteps with one of her beaus as a moment when she essentially marched him through what she thought were the phases of a relationship prematurely, when he thought they were happy. And she essentially provided the whole arc of how the way relationships work. And it's one of those examples in her mind of how she shoots herself in the foot in emotional terms.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Jim Shepherd about his latest novel, Phase Six. One last thing about the setting, not the physical setting, which we'll get to in a minute, but the ambience of the book, is that this pathogen gets released because of the excavations of a rare earths mining company. And these minerals are actually crucial for the transition to renewable energy. So it's kind of like ironies abound. Is that one of the things you wanted to bring in here, that, you know, this climate change thing is something we must solve, but it's tough?
It is tough. And it is exactly the kind of thing I wanted to bring in, where, you know, everything has a counterbalancing cost, right? And on the one hand, if you want to be a glass half empty kind of person, you think, oh, look, they're doing what they want to do and they're greenwashing. They're pretending that it's about renewable energy. But, you know, if you want to be a glass half full kind of person, you're like, well, it is, you know, we do need to find sources of renewable energy. And so what are we supposed to do, right? You know, when people say, well, get rid of carbon and do nuclear, you're like, well, wait a minute. And nuclear is even more problematic in some ways, right? So there are very difficult trade-offs that need to be made in order to solve the climate crisis. And of course, one of the things we're discovering as a human, 21st century human race, is that we don't like difficult trade-offs. We won't make difficult trade-offs. We prefer to just kick the can down the road.
So now let's talk about the novel itself and its protagonists. There is Alec. He is the boy at the center of the story, a 12-year-old boy. He lives in a native community in Greenland. Tell us about him and his community.
He comes from a very, very tiny community called Illimanaq, which is on the west coast of Greenland, which is a very, very isolated place. You have to fly to get to the next town. And the big city in that area, Ilulissat, is about the size of Williamstown, where I live, which is about, you know, 5,000 people. And that's considered the big city because it has, I think, two grocery stores or something like that. So they're very, very isolated places. And I always knew that I wanted one of my protagonists in the novel to be a child, first of all, because I tend to approach these sorts of problems from the worm's eye view. I don't tend to come at these problems from the top down in fictional terms. You know, what is it like to be the head of the CDC when there's a pandemic? I very much, that's not my experience in the world. So I very much come at it from, like, what's it like to be in a position where you don't know what's going on, but it's terrifying and you are wondering where you're going to get information from. In this case, too, what I wanted was that awful sense that a child has of suspecting that inadvertently or not, they've created a big, big problem, and not knowing whether or not they can open up about it. That feeling of, did I just do something awful? I don't even know if I want to investigate that, is something that emotionally seems very evocative to me too. I've also, with children, long been drawn to that sense they have that I think Henry James articulated very nicely, that, you know, when we're engaging their sensibilities in fiction, we register that they have so many more perceptions than they have vocabulary to give those perceptions voice. because that only not only seems very vivid and affective to me when I think about my own past, but it also really neatly parallels the dilemma that writers face. I think, you know, we're looking for the right words, but we often don't have them, you know.
Well, I think you found the right words in this book. I should let my listeners know that this was one of those rare books that I couldn't put down. I read from start to finish. And you are listening to Writer's Voice as we talk with Jim Shepherd about his new novel, Phase 6. So, and his community is under threat. Now, first of all, Greenland is a colony. His community's traditional way of life and subsistence has been threatened by climate change. And then this, you know, they allow this mining company to come in because they need some income, and it wipes them out.
Right. And, you know, that decision that all of these communities are facing, which is a very difficult decision, right, as it's a sort of a wonderful feedback loop, because as climate change limits their options, then they get even more and more economically receptive to the kind of devastating decisions that will limit their options even more. But they've got to eat, right? They've got to function as a community. And so it feels like a big bonanza when a mining company says, you know, we're coming in, we're going to, you know, we'll lease this land and don't worry about the rest of it. But there's obviously downsides to it. And in this case, the downsides are catastrophic.
Now, tell us about the CDC researchers. There's Janine and Denise. Tell us about them and, you know, how they are approaching the situation that they confront when they go to Greenland.
Well, you know, getting back to that worm's eye view thing, one of the things that my CDC sources helped me with, and I was fortunate enough to be able to work with Tom Friedan, who used to be a head of the CDC. One of the things they pointed out or reminded me was that the CDC has this wonderful policy of thinking that they should throw new people in to the deep, what they call the deep end of the pool when there's a mysterious outbreak. Since they figure those people will always be supported long distance anyway by the people back at the CDC. And so that seemed to me wonderfully evocative as well. The idea that you would be fairly new to the CDC and feel sort of terrified, like you're just getting your feet wet. And somebody says, you know, there's a pretty scary looking outbreak in this place that we haven't identified yet. You're up. And on top of that, I was struck by in my research by how often these sorts of investigators would have much more trouble if they were women because of the usual problems you would think women would run into. So that there would always be this sense of when you arrive on the scene, everybody looking dismayed and going, wait, they sent a woman? And so I thought, what would it be like if the CDC sent two women and those women were fairly close? And so the novel in some ways became about that, you know, trying to do your job in the face of that when your job is extraordinarily important, and the evolution of a really, really close friendship in the face of that between two people who are both quite reticent emotionally in some ways and feel as though they're not very good at interpersonal things. You know, they're better at numbers. And so as they're trying to solve these enormous and unprecedented problems, they're also getting more and more devoted to each other, and they're more and more terrified that they might let the other person down or something might happen to that other person or whatever. And that became a big emotional part of the book.
Yeah, it struck me that it seemed to me that apart from these larger issues and questions that the book deals with, it also deals with the need for the necessity of connection between people, that it's a book about people connecting with each other.
Mm-hmm. And I think part of what, you know, when you have a book about disaster, part of what keeps it from seeming either exploitative or excessively bleak is a sensitivity to the bonds that form in the midst of catastrophe and the importance of those bonds and the way in which what happens on the micro level can do so much to redeem in our own eyes what's happening on the macro level, right? Because the macro level is very often a disaster. And so the way we're there for one another otherwise, you know, one of the epigraphs of the novel Well, one of the epigraphs of the novel is everyone has a plan until they get punched in the mouth, the Mike Tyson line about boxing. But another one is by the scientist Jonathan Mann, who said, you know, our responsibility is historic for when the history of AIDS and the global response is written. Our most precious contribution may well be that at the time of the plague, we did not flee, we did not hide, and we did not separate. You know, and I always thought that was a very beautiful and moving comment for him to make.
Yes, and I took that kind of moral lesson also from this book. It's not just about, you know, the developing connections between the protagonists, but also about the need for us as human beings to be connected in the world when we confront catastrophe, or even in order to avert catastrophe.
Exactly.
Now, Alec is a sole survivor of his tiny community. How does he deal with this? I mean, he doesn't want to talk with the researchers. Why doesn't he? And talk about the trauma that he expresses.
Yeah, one of the things that you can do when you're writing fiction is mess with the lethality of your pathogen. And, you know, in the case of this pathogen, its lethality is off the charts before it starts mutating. And so that means that in this little community where it's first unleashed, pretty much everybody but him dies. And the sort of shocking totality of that seemed to me both something I was interested in dramatic terms, but also in emotional terms. The idea that a boy would not only feel as though he might have unleashed something that harmed his community, but annihilated his community, including his relatives and all of his friends. That seemed to me just such a staggering burden to lay on a boy that it then became a kind of emotional detective story in terms of my own imagination to get a sense of just how withdrawn he would be, just how utterly traumatized he would be. And so then it falls to Janine, one of the investigators, to try to get through to him, because there's always information from survivors that is crucially important to figuring out the history of the pathogenic outbreak.
And yet there's also then this kind of theme of exploitation, you know, the researchers want Alec to talk. On the other hand, he's this kid and he's an Inuit kid. You know, there are all these questions of how these white Western researchers relate to him. And there's this tension in the book, a moral quandary, if you will.
Yeah. And in fact, you know, he's flown to a site in Montana that is set up for just that kind of research, where you're essentially isolated and you're dealt with it's a level 4 facility for highly contagious and highly lethal pathogens. And they have essentially an apartment in there for people who have been contaminated but are still surviving and become sort of living guinea pigs. And if you imagine an Inuit boy who's never been outside of a very, very small community being flown by the Air National Guard to Montana and ending up in one of those facilities and becoming a lab rat, you have a sense of what I set out for one of my poor protagonists anyway. And on the one hand, Janine, one of the epidemiologists, has a very compassionate sense of what he's going through, and that's part of what allows her to start to connect to him. But on the other hand, you know, he is a problem to be solved, and they have a lot bigger issues that they have to face as far as they're concerned. And she's always felt like she's better with numbers than with people. And so the irony of her position is not lost on her. But she also registers that she's going to have to get better at this if she's going to get through to this kid. And the ethics of we're doing this because we need him, or we're doing this because we care about him, is always in front of her.
You know, I wanted to ask you, you as you said, you wrote the book before COVID, but you must have gone back to adjust it after the pandemic began, because the COVID pandemic is referenced in your book.
Right. What happened was I delivered it to Knopf in March of 2020, right as the pandemic was breaking. And they had, thank God, bought it in advance. So they were stuck with it one way or the other. And I think they thought, well, this is a pretty unprecedented problem. When do you release a book about a pandemic during a pandemic? And there was some debate as to whether to rush it out or to wait a little while. You know, normally a book is published 8 months or so after it's delivered. and give it some time, give the world some time to adjust to what was going on. And finally, the decision was made to wait. And once the decision was made to wait, then what was going on could be incorporated into the book, although in a very glancing way. Actually, the biggest distinction that waiting allowed, or the biggest changes that waiting allowed was, you know, with exposition, you're often, as a fiction writer, putting in stuff that people don't know and taking out stuff people already know. And I had in the book all of this stuff about what happens when a pandemic hits and, you know, how you go about trying to protect yourself. And all of that started to come out as the world learned that the hard way. And so the book actually became a thinner book because a lot of the stuff about, well, here's why masking is important, or here's what fomites are. All of that stuff could start to be pared back because the world, as I said, was getting a forced education in it.
That's so interesting. Now, how do you balance, or do you have any challenges in balancing an exposition with fiction?
Yeah, you sure do. Because as a fiction writer and as a nerd, you collect a lot of information and you think, wow, this is so cool. I got to put this somewhere. But I think the rule I try to operate by is all of this scientific information needs to serve the emotional through line. And when it's not doing that, when it's just a neat detail, it probably has to go. And so normally what will happen is I'll do years of research and I'll build up files of all sorts of cool details. And I'll think, oh, I can't wait to use that. And sometimes I'll go, oh, I know exactly where to use that detail. And sometimes I'll go, no, that detail is a little bit too much like another detail in the earlier chapter. And it's not serving any its emotional purpose. So it's going to have to be sacrificed, essentially. So, you know, as a writer, you try to be, you're kind of a pack rat. You want to save all the good stuff you've dug up. But as a dramatist, you have to sort of go, you know what, some of this stuff is clogging up just the pace of the book.
Is there anything I haven't asked that I should have?
No. You could have asked about the health of my beagles, but that's only that's kind of a glancing thing.
Okay. Well, it is a terrific book, a prescient book, an important book to read, and also a terrific read. Thank you so much, Jim Shepherd. The novel is Phase 6.
Thank you, Francesca.
Jim Shepherd. Find a link to an excerpt from Phase 6 at writersvoice.net. Next up, the greatest radio station in the world. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Sign up for the free Writer's Voice podcast and weekly newsletter at writersvoice.net. You can find more great content there, including web-only features like book recommendations and extended interviews. WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut has been the radio home of Writer's Voice for over a decade. I'm proud to be part of this terrific station, home to some of the best music and public affairs programming you can find on the radio dial and streaming on the web. So when the New Yorker magazine published a piece this year calling WPKN the greatest radio station in the world, I was thrilled that it was finally getting the national recognition it so richly deserved. Then filmmaker and WPKN listener Cobb Carlson came out with a documentary about the station. He named it after the New Yorker article, The Greatest Radio Station in the World. It premiered last month and is a headliner in the upcoming Bridgeport Film Festival beginning July 23rd. Cobb Carlson has been a film editor and producer on numerous films such as Farmageddon and on TV shows Frontline and Nova. In addition to The Greatest Radio Station in the World, he made the documentary Donald Ross, Discovering the Legend. Cobb Carlson, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Well, hi, Francesca. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
I just wanted to ask you first, why did you do this film, The Greatest Radio Station in the World?
Well, I've been involved in the world of primarily documentary film for the last 30 years, based in the Boston area. But I was born in Bridgeport, where WPCAN is located, and grew up in the town next door in Fairfield, and still have very strong ties to the area down there. And about 6 years ago, I had to move back half time to take care of my elderly dad. And I met the current general manager, Steve DiCostanzo, because I went in to do a little volunteer work. And when he heard I was worked in the film industry, he said, "Oh, why don't you do a documentary on PKN?" And I had just come off doing a 2-year documentary on a famous golf course architect, Donald Ross. And it was a kind of no budget labor of love. And I wasn't ready to embark on another project like that. So I told Steve that maybe he should get some student filmmakers and I'd be happy to consult or advise them. And that never happened. So then I got this job teaching film at Eastern Connecticut State University in Willimantic, Connecticut. And Steve found out about that and said, "Okay, now you can do the film because you'll have, you know, use of equipment and students to help you." So I relented and said, "Okay, let's go ahead. Let's do the film."
And are you glad you did so?
Oh, very much. Very much so. It was difficult and challenging to pull this off during the time of COVID. My first shoot was in February 2020. I went to the station by myself and filmed one programmer, Carl J. Frano, and I filmed some B-roll of the station. And then a month later, I went back with a few students and we filmed the Music Mash, which is the fundraiser that the station does in Bridgeport, where people who sell vinyl and albums and rock memorabilia and CDs come to the Reed's Art Space in downtown Bridgeport. And we filmed that. And then COVID hit and everything shut down. So the film was put on ice for a while until I could figure out how to continue doing socially distanced interviews and where programmers felt safe. And that was very tricky. And it ended up then for the next year and a half, but pretty much doing everything by myself. I did have some student help from a couple of graduate student filmmakers from Sacred Heart University who shot some B-roll of the programmers for me because I couldn't always travel down to Bridgeport timing-wise to get certain programmers doing their shows. And so I did get some help. And even Steve DiCostanzo, the station manager, was able on his iPhone to film a few things to fill in the gaps for me here and there. And that's how it went.
Yeah, and I noticed, you know, people were wearing masks during it. So it really does peg the time of filming, the era of filming. Yeah, and it's really has been on the air for such a long time. You know, I have to say I first knew about WPKN because my mother, I live in the house that was my mother's. I came to take care of her at the end of her life. And I noticed going through her things when she finally did pass away at the age of 92 in 2012, how many tapes that she had made of programs of WPKN that she had recorded to listen to. And I know from having gone through her, you know, her records that she was also a supporter. So that's one reason I reached out. I had my radio show Writer's Voice on the air at I lived in Massachusetts and it was at WMUA, which was a station that also began around the same time, also a student station, as this was, and still is a student and community radio station. But there, They're more of a student station, much less of a community station. It went the opposite way with WPKN. Talk about that evolution.
Well, I structured the film in chapters, and so I do provide some history and for context. And that's a big part of the story, the evolution from what was a standard student radio station back in the 60s and 70s to one that ended up evolving and involving more community members. Now, many of these community members were students who, once they graduated, just continued to do their radio shows. But then that opened up, and people who just happened to live in the area of Greater Bridgeport who were interested in doing radio were also allowed to get shows on the station. So the University of Bridgeport, in and of itself, is a fascinating story, how it was a thriving college in the 60s and 70s. I mean, it's a great location right on Long Island Sound, beautiful campus. Had a lot of students from Long Island, from New Jersey, from Connecticut, other parts of New York. And the city fell on hard economic times, kind of at the same time that the university fell on hard economic times because of teacher strikes. And one of the things that sort of, with the university struggling financially, radio wasn't very important to the administration. And it seemed like student interest was also on the wane. So the evolution became the community in kind of steps throughout the years. It became more and more a community radio station, to the point where the university gave up wanting it to be part of what they were offering, and they turned the station over to the community members who had been doing shows for many years.
And it became the greatest radio station in the world. Talk about that title.
Well, I did steal the title from David Owen, who wrote the article in The New Yorker last August, where in Talk of the Town, in the beginning of the magazine, he wrote a beautiful little two-page piece on why his subjective take was that this was the greatest radio station in the world. I happen to love the title. I wasn't totally thrilled with my working title, which was On the Air. And, you know, it's kind of one that I thought was sort of unique, but then it seems like it's used in a lot of things. So I was glad to borrow David's title. And it's got a lot of cachet. I think it gets people's attention. And in all honesty, I do feel it is the greatest radio station in the world. And I think that's evidenced hopefully by what I put in the film. And I think what really drives the film is the personalities of the programmers. And I think that's what gives WPKN its vitality, including shows like yours.
Very struck by something you say early in the film, The Greatest Radio Station in the World, Cobb Carlson, where you quote Jeff Telus, who was a very important figure in the beginning, in the founding of the station. He said, "You have not convinced a man just because you've silenced him." And you say something that could be the motto of the station. Why?
Well, that was that anecdotal story was conveyed by Stu Hackle, who was at the station in the early days. He was a music director and just very involved, had his own show, Radio Free Bridgeport, which was very political. He had on the Black Panthers and local activists, anti-war people. But yeah, it was a little bit of a misspeak on his part, because I found an image of that poster that Jeff had in his office, and it was actually of not it basically is the same meaning. You have not converted a man because you have silenced him, which is almost the same as convinced. And I just think it what it says is that all the programmers at PKN have the freedom to say and what they want on the air and play what they want on the air. And once you have a show, that really, I've never known a situation where that gets challenged to the point where you'll lose your show. So it's very unusual in America to have that kind of programming situation where all the DJs and programmers are allowed to do whatever they want.
Yes, and I can attest to that. I mean, I was a freelance reporter for an NPR station, and they carried my show for a while, for a few years. But every programmer at WPKN is doing this as a volunteer. We don't get paid. And I experience the self-censorship and the actual censorship that comes about when you work for, well, I'm sure other radio networks as well as NPR, but NPR was my experience. And that's why I do this for free, because I can say what I want and I get to choose what I want to program. And that really comes through in this film. Amazing shows. Now, it's a very heavy emphasis on the music programming, which is absolutely top rate, top flight. And I think that's really what was behind that article in The New Yorker that called it the greatest radio station in the world. Later on, we'll talk a little bit about the spoken word programming, because that's also very important. But talk about the music and how the music expresses the, the spirit of the station.
Right. I think that, yes, the music is the sort of predominant programming at the station. I tried to let it be known that public affairs shows like yours, spoken word shows, informative shows, the few talk shows that are on there all contribute to this great potpourri that the station is. But I think it's the love of music and the passion for music that really is drives the engine of the station. And it's very diverse. And I tried to show that with the just the different genres of music, the different ethnicities of programmers, and the kinds of music that they're playing, whether it be reggae or Latin music or bluegrass. It's quite an amazing stew that rich in spices and flavor.
One of my favorite stories in this film, The Greatest Radio Station in the World, is the one that Mark Mushin tells about his daughter Alyssa and the song that Kelly Z wrote for her. Talk about that.
Well, in all honesty, when I interviewed Mark, I kind of knew a little bit about his daughter. I had seen a couple postings, but when I asked him the question, and he just picked up the ball and ran with it. I was in tears at the end of his story. I was all choked up, and I knew it had to get in the film if I would react that way. My hope was that other people would react that way, because it just had so much heart. And I think that there were a few kind of fun anecdotal stories that I tried to include in the film, but that one really had a lot of emotion, and it's just a sweet story. And Mark is a great guy, and is not only on two different shows, his own blues show and the Car Bob show, the talk show about how you can they answer all kinds of car questions. But he does a lot of volunteer work. He's very talented as a mechanic, and he just, you know, he just knows electronics, and so yeah, had to get Mark in the film by all means.
And tell us the story.
Oh, the story of his special needs daughter, Alyssa, and I think how it ties in with the blues program that he does, and this performer Kelly Z wrote a song about Alyssa after Alyssa had passed away at a very young age, tragically. And I think without giving away too much, she had never spoken a word in her life, Mark's daughter, and that has a lot to do with his little story and how, you know, a beautiful little human being she was.
Wrapped in your mind, and easier to feel than to search out and find. And Alyssa, she knew the way to get you through. She was never behind, but one step ahead of the blues. Just don't know what's right there to see. Looking for easy to set them free. And Alyssa, she knew these things don't get you through. And she was never behind, but one step ahead of the blues.
That was a clip from Alyssa by Kelly Z of the band Kelly's Lot. And you are listening to Writer's Voice. We're talking with filmmaker Cobb Carlson about his film The Greatest Radio Station in the World. It will show as the headline film at the Bridgeport Film Festival on July 23rd in Bridgeport, Connecticut. There are also other programmers who talk about, I'm thinking one in particular, but I did not write down the name here, yeah. Who talks about music as a force for organizing.
Luis Luna, young Latinx programmer, and in his real day job, he's a community organizer and works on immigrant rights, does great work in Connecticut, and is able to not only play really fun, cutting edge Latin music on his show, but he also uses his show as a platform to try and promote social change.
There's some pretty famous people who are also programmers. You've got Chris France from the Talking Heads, Mark Naftalin, who was in the Paul Butterfield Band. Talk a little bit about just the wealth of talent that is brought to WPKN by the programmers.
Well, if any of your listeners go to the PKN website and do a little navigating, you'll see there is a page for the documentary. And I've also, besides the recently completed film, there are some short segments that I dropped for the station to kind of tease the film as we're getting close. And one of them is called What I Do. And it's people telling us what they do when they're not programming at PKN. So what their day jobs are in the real world, which is really fun because you have someone like Beanie Klein, who's a psychologist at Yale University. You have, you know, like I said, car mechanics. You have people who have written for the New York Times. And then, yeah, I didn't interview Mark, but interviewed Chris France from the Talking Heads. He was a complete gentleman, very gracious with his time. He's witty, he's smart, and just written his book. And so he was having people like that at the station it's a big plus for the station to have a few, because and he does a great music show and has a lot of fun on the air, and he does sort of exemplify what the whole station is like.
Yes, and I was also struck by Andy Poneros. His show, Cosmic Perspective, it was named by NASA as an important outlet for education about astrophysics.
Yeah, that's a well-kept secret. Only one or two stations in the country. And that, you know, it's a great thing he does, just talking about space and space exploration. And, you know, and again, that's just the wide breadth of programming you get on this station. There is really, you know, there is no station like it anywhere.
You know, what's so interesting for me as a radio programmer who loves the audio medium for the intensity of focus, for the intimacy of it, is that you used a visual medium to explore an audio medium. And I wonder if you could talk about that and your approach and what might have been some of the challenges of using a visual, audio-visual medium to explore an audio-only medium.
Well, it's the one interesting thing I have to say is it was challenging because the old station at PKN was very small, where the studios were. So it was hard. It posed challenges for filming in a tight area. So I had to use quite a bit of wide angle lens when I filmed programmers doing their shows. And it sort of, there's only a certain amount of angles you can use. But one thing that's fascinating about filming radio programmers is that there were a number of people at the station who just did not want to be in the film, did not want to be filmed, which was fine. I, you know, respect their wants and you know, it was really a matter of choice whether you wanted to be in this movie. But I think part of that was some people really liked the anonymity of just being known for their voice and being, you know, kind of this a little bit of mystery involved to being a programmer and a DJ. And film sort of pulls the curtain aside and lets the audience see, you know, what goes on at the radio station. Often you're just hearing the music and hearing the programmer speak and wax poetic. So, you know, I think that's one most definitely an interesting aspect to the film.
And the film, and we only have time for just a little bit. There's so much more in this film. Very interesting also the exploration of how the almost, I guess you could say, kind of anarchic in a good way.
Yeah.
I'm an anarchist, so I see anarchism as direct democracy. You know, how the station deals with conflict, how they deal with decision making, and, you know, the fact that you need to have leadership at a station, especially when you have mostly volunteers, and how that interplay between leadership and democracy happens. So there's so much more to this wonderful film. Cobb Carlson, you are the creator of the greatest radio station in the world, the filmmaker. It's going to have a live show in Bridgeport. Is that? Tell us about that and when.
Yes, we had a nice premiere a couple weeks ago at the Bijou Theater, where in downtown Bridgeport, where the new studios for the radio station are right above the Bijou Theater, and I was able actually to film most of my interviews with programmers on the stage at the Bijou. So that was a big success for the station. They raised a nice little chunk of change. But the next screening, which will be a little more reasonably priced for people who would like to come out and see the film, will be at the Bridgeport Film Festival on July 23rd, a week from this upcoming Saturday. And it's a somewhat new film festival. It's in its second year. And my film, lucky for me, will be the headlining film. It will be showing at the Klein Memorial Auditorium, which is an amazing performance space, a great place to hear concerts. And I haven't seen what the screen is, but I know the sound will be great in there. And yeah, tickets are on sale now. I think if you get in now, you can get a ticket for $10. If you come day of, I think they're $15. So I encourage people to come out to support the Bridgeport Film Festival and the Klein Memorial Theater and support the radio station again and this little film.
That's great. And for those listeners who are around the country and the world, is there a way that they will be able to view the film as well? Will it be streaming?
I'm working on that. It's a tricky thing these days. There's a lot of choices out there, a lot of movies, a lot of platforms, a lot of music. So I would like to get it on one of the larger streaming platforms, but it is going to take a little time. But I hope to have that in place by the fall. And I'm sure we'll get the word out through the station, whether, you know, the film will be on Hulu or HBO 2. Who will see? I have a niece who works in the business, and I'm hoping that she'll be able to help me pull that off. Because for a little tiny film like this, it's you don't have an agent or an entertainment lawyer. It can be kind of tricky to navigate those waters these days. But I think there's a really good chance it'll be available on a streaming platform. Worst case scenario, I build my own website and we stream it from there.
Well, that's great because it is a great film about the greatest radio station in the world. Cobb Carlson, thank you so much for talking with us on Writer's Voice.
Well, thank you for your kind words, Francesca, and appreciate you having me on.
Cobb Carlson. Go to writersvoice.net for a link to the trailer for the greatest radio station in the world. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.